Gotta get going while I can't stay along now.
Welcome to a podcast roundtable on the 40th anniversary of Woodstock, looking back at the way the New York Times covered the festival in 1969 and the reality versus the myth.
Okay, people, we got a time. Sit there. Look at all those people around you. Get acquainted. Have a smoke.
Alan Fay, go to the information booth. Your friend is very ill. Alan Fay.
From Harvard, the hitchhikers you need, the hitchhikers you picked up need the pills in your car. Please go to the information station right away.
John Perellis, the chief pop critic, is the moderator, and joining him are three reporters who endured the mud for the Times: Mike Kaufman, Barney Collier, and Mike John.
Why don't you each introduce yourselves?
I'm Barnard, or Barney Collier.
Mike John.
Mike Kaufman.
And then I'm John Perellis, and these three guys were covering Woodstock back in 1969 for the New York Times. I myself was at Woodstock at age 15. My brother had to drive me, but you guys were working. I want to read something Bernie wrote, which I think captured the flavor of it, considering it was 69. He wrote, "Drawn by such performers as Joan Baez, Ravi Shankar, Jimi Hendrix, and the Jefferson Airplane,
the prospect of drugs and the excitement of making a scene, the young people came in droves, camping in the woods, romping in the mud, talking, smoking, and listening to wailing music."
That's pretty true to my experience. How did the Times end up sending you? Did you volunteer?
There's two ways to tell this story. One is the actual way, and one is the mythological way, so I'll tell it the actual way.
Good journalism.
It was a Thursday, and I asked Don Forst, who was in the department of making decisions at that time, and I said, "I'd like to go up to Woodstock," because a month before I had written a story called "The Underground Industrial Complex" about a big rock concert in Atlanta in the Speedway, where they got 125,000 people, which was up to that time about the biggest. And in the story, I said that there's going to be another one of these, because the reason for the Atlanta one doing so well had not been fulfilled. Word was on all of the grapevines and all the little radio stations that there was going to be a shipment of drugs, good drugs, from Mexico. And they were going to either get to the Atlanta Pop Festival, or they were going to get to a little place nobody had ever heard of called Woodstock. I asked Don, I said, "There's going to be something good happening at Woodstock, and I'd like to go." And he said, "Nah, there's no way we're coming to a rock concert on the weekend. We're not sending anybody." So I went anyway. So I went in our little car up to Woodstock, and suddenly we began to realize we had come into a different world, because the parking was 4 miles away. We had to park the car 4 miles away in the median.
So this was a family excursion?
So this was a family excursion, and it was for a lot of people. There was a press tent, but there were no press there. So we went down there, and I realized that it was a major story. That was when I realized the breadth of the thing. I got there on the Friday.
And it was already mobbed.
It was already mobbed. And so I called the desk, as I was wont to do, and I said, "This is a pretty good story." And they said, "Yeah, you got to cover it." The event was secondary in a lot of people's minds. The music wasn't as big a draw as the prospect of finally getting a hold of some Mexican something or another. And this was essentially one of the major reasons why people came. Wow. And, of course, at the same time, there were a lot of people prepared for it. There was a group called the Hog Farmers, I think it was, who were prepared for all the LSD overdoses that they knew were going to happen.
Right.
And then there were a lot of other people that were prepared for all the other drugs that were going to happen. And I'm sure if you were there, that if you opened your eyes a little bit at the time, you might have seen a drug or two and inhaled.
I saw a couple of drugs.
So, at any rate, you know what I'm talking about.
People were smoking cigarettes. It did not smell like cigarettes to me.
That could have been.
So did you call for reinforcements at some point?
it was obvious that I was out over my head after the, well, the first day, nobody knew. Woodstock was nothing. Woodstock, the problem, really, the big problem was the editors wanted to make it a disaster story.
Mm-hmm.
And they really did. They wanted to make it a story of a terrible traffic jam and a lot of people smoking drugs or doing drugs. And they and that it was a police thing, and then it was policemen shouldn't be there even because there were drugs on the scene, et cetera, which is what they wanted to make it. It finally had to go through a run of editors because I said that's not the story and I won't write it. Mm-hmm. That had to finally go all the way up to Scotty Reston.
Right.
And he said, if he sees it that way, that's the way we're going to put it. And so they still made it a story where it led with the traffic jam. Maybe today it wouldn't lead with a traffic jam, but at that time it led with a traffic jam. But the rest of the story, as you read, pretty much they left it pristine.
Well, no, I mean, you can see the amazement of everybody at how well-behaved people were.
It was huge. It was astonishing. Nobody was killing anybody, and everybody had a pre-mindset that was what would happen if you ever got that sort of crowd together.
Suck to you. All your lovers like a rainbow. Your lovers like a rainbow, darling. Your lovers like a rainbow. Your lovers like a I'm falling all around my shoulders, yeah. I'm falling all around my shoulders, you know that you're.
When did you guys arrive?
I guess my experience was parallel to yours, Barney. I didn't want to go there. I just resented the whole, I did not want to go. I heard of it, and I had known all those people, or had seen them play before. I didn't want to see them play in the cow pasture. And I grew up on the farm, and I was acquainted with cow pastures, and I just didn't really see myself doing this. But I find out now from reading Arthur Gubb's book that they had planned this. And in fact, one of the reasons I was hired was to cover Woodstock. And so they knew that way before, because I was hired in like September, October of 68. And so they had an idea what was going on. So, but I still did not want to go. I wanted to go to Newport, but that was no, absolute no on that. So, you know, up I went, and my wife and I and my friend Richard rented a car, and we were just driving up, and we hit the traffic jam. And fortunately, we found a motel nearby. And I had to abandon the car, actually, and not in the median on the side. And we came back 3 days later with somebody sleeping on top of it. But I called the culture desk, and I said, hey, look, this is a huge traffic jam. This is a big story. This is not me, the reviewer, covering it. You need send a hard news team, because this ain't me.
What I remember is I was on vacation. And I was on vacation in the Western Catskills. And I got a phone call. My wife and three kids are there. And the phone call is, could I come to the city and get on the helicopter? They will fly me up. And I say, that's stupid. I will rent a car and I'll try to get there. And if I can get there, I'll get there and help out. And if I can't get there, I'll write a story about trying to get there and I'll work behind the lines. So I drive and I get pretty close. I use back roads and I get about 6 miles and I walk. It's hard for me to imagine today that there ever was a time when I would walk 6 miles.
And think it was nothing.
I was just completely overwhelmed. And it was, I won't say I had this idea the first day, but by the second day, I had realized that this was the second time in my life that I was watching consciousness change in the course of an afternoon or two. The first time was in 63 when I was at the March on Washington and heard the Martin Luther King speech. In that instance, the people had come timid and left proud. Here, the big element, now I didn't get all of this in the full moment, but when I look back upon it, at some point, my awareness arose that this was a proclamation, that the element here was surprise. Not only the surprise of the New York Times, not only the surprise of the authorities, not only the surprise of the viewing public, but the surprise of the participating public, the people.
But that's what I remember being a kid. I thought, wow, there's all these people who are interested in the same things I am.
Exactly. And one of the things that struck me is how white the crowd was. this was a white middle-class crowd. I kept running into kids who said that they had left their cars somewhere and they didn't really know where they were, and they didn't seem to much care about it. And it seemed to me like something was happening. Now, I don't think it was very political. I mean, it was billed as politics, but in fact, I think it was political in one sense, and that is, this was a time when 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds were being drafted and sent to a war, and those same people could not vote. This was a time when the first adolescence of the boomers was taking place. I don't presume to tell you that I thought that up at the time, but it was an awareness that grew on me, that the boomers. And this was a time when marketers had already singled out this age group for special attention. They were selling jeans, they were selling sneakers, they were selling music, they were selling films to this group, which was, in one sense, must have understood that they were important. On another sense, we're being totally ignored. And my sense of things was that all of these factors, I was so much more fast. I don't think I heard any bands when I was up there.
Not a one?
I didn't care that much. I liked the music. I knew Country Joe, and I knew who was there. I wish I had heard Hendrix. But I was so fascinated by the crowd and the interaction of that crowd with the host crowd, with the older Catskill Yenters. who turned equally human. This was a humanizing experiment. People came to respect each other, and that was so dominant. It really showed the humanity, the self-respect of the mm-hmm. crowd. I ended up writing, one of those pieces I wrote was about the Monticello community rallying to support, and sheriffs going around saying, I've never seen kids like this. This is wonderful.
I was put off by all of the flower stuff. I always put off by the flower stuff. And I'm the only person of that age group who made it the entire 60s and 70s without once touching something that was tie-dyed. And I'm very proud of that. And I've thought the whole thing, I thought it was stupid. I didn't get it. To me, it was like a disaster. And I think the first piece I wrote was that for those who came there for the music, the first day at least was a complete disaster. I don't know if that was the word in that piece, but I did use it. I did not. I went out once to sleep, and the rest of the time was there all the time. I did not go to the celebrity tent. There was a tent right near the stage, an area for the bands and whoever else could sneak in. And that was the big drug area where the fancy drugs were. Mm-hmm. And Jefferson Airplane had spiked everything. And I did not go there because I knew those people too. I did not want to hang out with them. So I walked around a lot. And I was there to say what band showed up, what they played, and some other facts, and throw in some sort of general observations.
But well, did the music grab you, though? I mean,
no. The only thing that really grabbed me that I saw was Sly Stone.
That was the peak, lots of us.
Pete Fornatale just put out a book called Back to the Garden. We all agree on that. His performance of I Want to Take You Higher was just outstanding. Didn't see anything that I regarded as being love and flowers or anything. I saw, to me, it was like those old pictures of Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. It was bodies hunched in the rain under blankets. Obviously, it smelled a lot of grass, but I didn't see any of the wonderfulness that we've associated with it. My belief is that had there been transportation, 90% of the people would have left. That's my feeling.
So you think the whole flowers and love vibe is a myth?
Well, I think it's how we wanted to see it. But I don't think that Woodstock, it didn't grab me. It grabbed me. I think it became wonderful in retrospect. Because I went there, I hated it the whole time. I went home and I had filed a couple of stories. And I had also, the Times was running a syndicated column that I wrote, and those days went around the country. I wasn't even going to write about it. I just thought the whole thing was ridiculous. But I finally did. And I say pretty much what I'm what I'm saying here. I think it became mythologized in retrospect.
Well, I got it.
But then again, I didn't go to, I just went out with the people, you see, quote unquote, that's my bias, is to, you know, hang out with the proletariat, right. And which is what I did. And
the
I didn't
proletariat
see
was having a very nice time. I mean, I can well understand how you could feel that way. And nobody probably did get to know the music if they were any further away than 300 feet from the stage, because it was just too big, it was just too difficult, and nobody could actually hear it. If you were up close and personal, you could get the full blast of it. What doesn't get thought about in the mythology of it, and doesn't often get said, was that 4 years before the pill arrived on the scene. Yeah. And people forget the power of what happened when the pill arrived on the scene, but Woodstock was about the time it took for it to become a sufficient amount of drugs among the population that it made a difference. And the fact that men and women could be together even in a situation like that for all of that time and not have to worry about it. And there were very few stories a year later that this baby was conceived at Woodstock. Yeah. Women there understood what birth control was and used it. People who used drugs understood what drugs were, and basically only the morons overdosed. There was a whole group of people to help out sort of things. The sheriffs had children that were there, and a lot of the police officers were on their side, more or less, because they had kids that were the same age, and they didn't want to have to worry about them getting busted. People survived it because of a lot of goodwill, but there was a lot of ill will, too. There were a lot of people in town who were supposedly these wonderful rural people who were selling water for 35 cents for a sip, you know?
Right.
There were a whole lot of things that went on that were fairly commercial, but the overall impact of the thing, the overall feeling of the thing, backstage, the feeling was business. The feeling was, you know, some people backed out because they didn't get paid. Some people were worried about getting paid. Other people had to be talked into it. And probably the rightfully so, in my estimation, the absolute moment when you knew you were hearing something different and something sensational. I was typing a story about 9:30 in the morning. I finally got to use a typewriter because it was early in the morning. I was typing something at about 9:30 in the morning, and suddenly a hair on the back of my neck stands up, and I'm listening to these guitar chords, and it was Jimi Hendrix doing the MiGs and the Navy planes in the Star Spangled Banner. Well, in those days, you didn't mess with the Star Spangled Banner. People Right. forget that that was one thing. You could burn a flag, but you didn't mess with the Star Spangled Banner. And he was messing with the Star Spangled Banner, and everybody knew it. And it was a most amazing piece of music. And I didn't see it happen because I was in the back, but I heard it happen. And everybody around me was in the same way, just hit by the lightning of the genius of it.
Steinberg was then a comedian, now I think he's a Hollywood producer, had said the most wonderful thing. He said, if Woodstock were held 5,000 years ago, today we would celebrate it as a Jewish holiday. Half a million people sitting in the rain with in the mud, covered by blankets, within the far off sound of thunder. And I think he's right. Yeah.
He is right. It was a biblical scene. That's what made it so powerful.
But as I said, I share the wonder of it, and it remains, along with Martin Luther King and the tragic prison rebellion that I covered in Attica, they together form a pastiche for me of that period.
Well, was it a moment of, was it frustration? Was it just a gathering of a certain mass of people? Was it energy in the air?
No, well, it was the proclamation of a group that was perceiving itself as a group with some collectivity. These were children resenting the comforts that their parents, in some ways, resenting and alienating themselves from the comforts that their parents were sacrificing to offer them. And I think that sense of proclamation, that sense of you were there at the time.
I think Woodstock was the senior prom for the 60s. I think after that, it was on to the series. Okay, now time to get back to ending the war.
What have people gotten wrong over the last 40 years? What, as people who were actually there before the myth was built, what's wrong with the myth?
I just think it's horribly over-mythologized. I think it was nothing like it's been made out to be. On the other hand, I deliberately did not go out looking for fun, looking to see where the good drugs were or where the musicians were hanging out. I wanted to see what 90% of the people were doing. And to me, 90% of the people seemed pretty unhappy and would have left if the ability to do so. But, you know, I did not have to cover that. I was there to write about what band showed up on stage and what they played and adding a few general facts. I did not have to work hard like you guys. I just had to walk around and absorb it.
What do you think is right and wrong about the myth?
There's a lot of right about it. I'll just point out what I see is right about it. It said it was about love, and basically it kept its promise. There wasn't much hate visible, even in the musicianship. So if the opposite of hate is love, there was a lot of love around Woodstock. And I think that had to do a lot with how nicely people treated each other. They treated each other gently. They treated each other with a lot of generosity. And they treated each other with a lot of respect. And so you had a crowd, admittedly, of white young people together with a lot of really wigged out musicians who were never seen anything like it before. Seeing 400,000 people at your feet or some such number from the lofty position of a stage, you get a different impression of what's actually going on. And they had to be nice to each other. All of those things were there that were real. And it's very easy to go after the stuff that's doesn't suit your taste or doesn't fit your stomach or whatever. But these were people who were just finding a way to get along with one another. And the music was in the background. It was a perfect anarchy. And a lot of people who were leftists and rightists love anarchy and could appreciate where leftism and rightism come together. It comes together in anarchy, and very seldom does anarchy fun. But in this case, anarchy was great fun. Most of the people were beautiful when they came in and were beautiful when they went out. The businessmen who handled it with great aplomb. I mean, it could have been terrible what happened, but Mike Lang and the people who handled it with great diplomacy and strength.
Well, what do you mean?
There were agents and acts and so forth and so on who could have caused them so much more problems, and they put their money on the line, they put their reputations on the line, they put their families on the line.
No, they went and opened a bank for the Who, I think, or something.
Yeah, whatever they did, they got them to do what they were supposed to do because the crowd expected it.
Taking down the fence?
Taking down the fence and allowing the fence to come down. I know.
Sort of smart to announce it, too. I think it changed the feeling of some people resented that I paid my $7 for my ticket.
The guy who gets little credit, but it deserves a lot of credit, was the guy who was the announcer. All the announcers, and managed to tell the crowd in a way that was very neat and a lot of times really funny about what was going on and who needed what.
To get back to the warning that I've received, you may take it with however many grains of salt you wish, that the brown acid that is circulating around us is not specifically too good. It's suggested that you do stay away from that. Of course, it's your own trip, so be my guest. But please be advised that there is a warning on that one, okay?
Basically, this wouldn't be repeated.
And I figured that Woodstock changed my life because look what I ended up doing for a living. So, lucky me. Anyway, you guys have been great. Thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you.
That's the end of our Woodstock podcast. I'm Saya Michael, the pop music editor. Thanks for listening.
If you smile at me, I will understand. 'Cause that is something everybody everywhere is in the same.